Hello, good evening, and welcome to The Game Is About Glory, our first one of 2023. I'm your host, Steph, and joining me tonight are Milo and Ricky. Hello, chaps. I hope other than today's game against Villa, the holidays have been good for you.
Happy New Year, Steph. Yeah. Happy New Year, all our Tottenham fans. Let's get off to a flyer.
Hello. Happy New Year. The football's been shit, isn't it?
It's not been great. And I have to just warn our listeners that our usual high production values, which erase all the squeaks, oohs, ahs, bumps, and that's not going to be the case this week. We're going to try and make this a live podcast. So you will hear warts and all. Both on and off the pitch, actually, I suppose it's fair to say. Look, it's been no secret that we kept the Games About Glory's home fires burning by landing you with a couple of pre-recorded specials so as you could grab that holiday breather and enjoy that wonderful time between Christmas and New Year without the sort of cyclic Spurs conversations which chaps sadly commenced with the resumption of the 2022-23 season, flub number one there, on Boxing Day at Brentford. That's a game we are going to be taking a look back at a little later, that 2-2 draw. But first, we will be fixing our immediate match spotlight in just a few minutes on the first game of 2023 earlier today at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium against Aston Villa that ended in a 2-0 defeat, which threw up plenty of discussion points. I said in a few minutes, the truth is it would probably be a little longer than that. But anyway, before all of it, we're going to start with the week. Oh, I suppose it's the week that was, but perhaps, chaps, it's the few weeks that were. As let's all come together here if we can. This was and is our first recording since the World Cup final. So congratulations to QD, right, chaps?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Well done, mate.
A World Cup winner with Argentina. Many, many congratulations to him. And this is a line that we wrote into the script before today's game. Our much maligned defence now contains two World Cup winners. We can talk about that later. And then we'd written in, had we not, Milo, bring that form with you, please, QT. Ah, well, chaps, enough. We'll get to it later. But how about a quick 30-second reflection on the final itself, that fantastic final between Argentina and France?
Yep, fantastic. One of the best finals ever, do you think? I think it definitely was, the way it turned out. And obviously, most people got the result they wanted, seeing Messi complete his career in... Well, not complete his career. He's still going to crack on, isn't he? But, climbing that mountain with Argentina, he's always wanted to climb. And it's a beautiful contrast to Ronaldo's shirt-holding 500 grand a day contract that he's got somewhere out in the...
Oh, that's right, yeah.
...Middle East.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You, Steph, so, you enjoy it?
I thought it was one of the most boring finals I'd seen until the 70th minute when it exploded into life, thanks to one man, Kylian Mbappe, who I thought was sensational.
You should be used to games that are boring for 70 minutes and then spring to life.
But the bit
we're
missing,
like that, actually.
The bit we're missing there is that we don't have a Kylian Mbappe to suddenly re-engage the love. But yes, point well made. But I thought Mbappe was sensational. And by the way, I was glad to see that Aston Villa either dropped or didn't play Emi Martinez today, because what an absolute buffoon. I mean, how to undermine your own country's fantastic win. His behaviour towards Mbappe has been nothing short of a disgrace, in my opinion. But anyway, well done, Cutie. Another World Cup winner at the lane. And also, we had another South American winner at this year's tournament, with Richarlison's bicycle kick against Serbia being voted the goal of the tournament. Have we talked about this yet before? We haven't?
I think you may have touched on it, Steph, yes.
Maybe. We have, of course. And it also gives us an excuse to play this again.
Hang on, I'm not sure I can. I'm not sure I have.
We're going live, as we said, and it looks like technology is going to get
gone,
the better.
It's disappeared.
It's disappeared, but I can go if you want. Richarlison, goal! Richarlison! Is that passable?
Just about.
Did he turn it?
I know that he can't cut it this week, because we're going... So, you know, let's give our loyal listenership a little break from my dulcet tones, shall we, Milo? Would you read this next bit of the weeks that were, the week that has just been here?
Legendary Spurs keeper Pat Jennings has been awarded a CBE in the UK's New Year's Honours list for services to football and charity.
I mean, what can we say about Pat that hasn't been said already?
Lovely man.
Yes.
Yeah. Lovely hair.
Incredible, his hair, doesn't it? It never moved. It never moved. It was like as formidable a helmet as his hands were formidable in their own right, if you know what I mean. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Is he the only Tottenham Arsenal sort of, you know, transfer that both clubs love and that neither holds against the other? Do you know what I mean? Is he the only player that's made that journey that nobody dislikes on either side of the fence? He's got to be, right?
I think he's got to be close to it. I
can't think of anyone else.
Yeah. No one. I mean, maybe it's another reflection of the man he is. No one's got a bad word to say about him, really.
No. And I mean, it's over 600 appearances, if I'm not incorrect. I do not have my stats in front of me. And at this point, I'm sure Gareth is listening, shaking his fist at the broadcast and just, you know, saying, you fools, this is the sort of statistic we should instantly have. But it's over 600 appearances, at least. I think 657 is a figure that sticks in my mind. If anyone wants to correct that, please feel free.
I mean, to cement his legendary status, are we the only club he does the ambassador stuff for?
Yes, I think so.
Oh, so he's seen the light in the end, you know, right side of North London. So that's good to know.
And can I just say one more thing about Pat? And sorry, I know Milo is trying to butt in, but I'm sort of taking advantage of this brief moment here. I love Pat's voice. It just sounds, it's the deepest, warmest, just what a tone. What a tone. It reminds me of that chap in the Father Ted Christmas special who says, "Would you please take your portraitises to the front?" It's got that kind of deep timbre to it. But Milo, please say something sensible.
I was just going to move us on to Deki getting Swedish Player of the Year.
And a wonderful move, indeed.
He's won the, apologies for pronunciation here, Golden Bollen, or the Swedish Male Player of the Year Award, basically the Ballon d'Or of Swedish football. So good for him. There were some nice quotes from him in here, but I cut them out for time and then didn't realise that we'd spend 5 minutes talking about Pat Jennings.
Big Pat.
I like that. I'm going to hazard a guess that the Guldbollen is the golden ball in Swedish.
Is.
There you go. Who didn't say that we don't? You know, we should. Simon is now shaking. Simon is shaking his fist at the broadcast saying, "You absolute Luddites. How could you even question that it is anything other than?" So, look, we also got sad news just after Christmas. I think it was news that maybe those of us who follow the game regularly will have seen coming for a couple of weeks. Pele finally passed. He'd been in hospital receiving treatment for cancer for a while, and Brazilian players and fans have been paying tribute to him throughout the World Cup. He's widely regarded as the greatest footballer the game has ever seen, and he remains the only player to have ever won the World Cup 3 times. Which is just, you know, an incredible feat. And his impact on the game is absolutely inarguable. It's beyond debate, isn't it, chaps? He was an inspiration to countless kids and adults. And, you know, he's in that elite group of greatest sports people of the 20th century. And I have to say, my friend Gary Lord put it really well. He said, you know, Elvis, you know, Pele, he said, even Jesus needed a second name. So, and Ali, he threw Ali in there as well, which I thought was really well put. But chaps, maybe a quick reflection?
Oh, 100%. I mean, when you're a kid and you're in awe of people like that, especially at our age, at all our ages really, he was the one legend that just seemed to transcend the game as being the greatest footballer. And I don't think people really contested it either. And, you know, media was different then. You didn't get to see people so much and you couldn't analyse things as much. But the people that did see those games and visit those tournaments just would wax lyrical about him all the time. And I suppose it took almost all the way till Maradona turned up for anyone to really kind of challenge that. And I'd like to say as well, I like some of the stuff I've seen on the internet, how they seem to be really close and good friends when, you know, that's Argentina v Brazil. I mean, and obviously Maradona's a bit of a kind of madman, but they both know that they were exceptional footballers and loved the game to bits. So that was nice to see as well.
Yeah, I think it was kind of particularly poignant. Maybe, you know, you mentioned earlier on about Messi finally winning the World Cup this year and, you know, obviously, you know, kind of sealing his claim to greatness. But yeah, that kind of just brought it home a bit more, I suppose. I mean, the remarkable thing with Pelé is, I mean, obviously I'm never lucky enough to see him play, but, you know, kind of how young he was when he broke through and then how long he was playing for. Just remarkable.
I mean, it was interesting. They asked, I mean, you brought up Messi. I think it's an interesting little tangent. Sir Alex Ferguson was asked, I think, after Barcelona beat Man United, you know, 15 years ago in the Champions League final at Wembley 3-1, you know, does Lionel Messi deserve to be in the same category as Pele and Maradona? And he said, look, he said, you evaluate a player of that stature on whether they could play in any era
and still be as brilliant as they were. And he said, in my opinion, Messi does fit that. And you would undoubtedly argue that Pelé is exactly that as well. And, you know, the other thing with Pelé, well, many things, but one of the other things that can never be overstressed is that much like Muhammad Ali opened up so much to the world in terms of boxing and also in terms of black superstardom as well. I mean, Pelé did the same. He did the same for football as a sport and also for black athletes in, you know, and black footballers. Yeah. I mean, it was dual track. And actually, Neymar made that point, which I thought was really good. So, you know, I just want to finish with this little stat. I think I put it in our WhatsApp group, actually. It's just an incredible set of stats about Pelé. And it just, you realize how much we all took it for granted, you know. And I mean, I certainly did. You know, what an incredible athlete he was. You know, the New York Times put in 1975, they said that Pelé's heartbeat at 56 to 58 times a minute in training, I mean, I think if mine beats that much when I'm asleep, I'm lucky. The heart of an average athlete in training beats at 90 to 95 times a minute. His peripheral vision was 30% greater than that of the average athlete. And Pelé could run 100 meters in 11 seconds and jump almost 6 feet high. Now, as much as I'd like to tell you that I can replicate those feats on a Tuesday, you know, in my game, I mean, seriously, think about those. Think about that. And then you add the talent. And a final word, you were mentioning Maradona and Pelé being so close. These guys came from nothing. I mean, they had nothing and they made everything. So, yeah. Wow.
There's a video out there of Pelé doing, of modern players doing certain moves, certain tricks, certain goals. And intertwined with that is Pelé doing exactly the same things as that. And people were saying, you know, who's the original GOAT? Who's the original? And it's a mind-blowing video because you just think, wow, this is from the 60s and the 70s. And he's doing all those tricks kind of first, really. Amazing athlete, as you say, Steph.
Yeah, there's that brilliant dummy that he does as well in 1970. It's absolutely brilliant. I mean, he deserved a goal, but it was just astounding. Anyway, we're having fun talking about a great footballer and a great man. So it's only fitting that we now move on then to the transfer window. That should knock the fun out of us, shouldn't it, chaps? Yeah. And by the way, once again, you know, we wish Pelé's family all the best, I think, like everyone. So, and it was nice to see the tributes today to him. Very good. Sorry, I just realised. I'm trying to postpone getting into the transfer window discussion. That's what I'm doing. But enough. It's open. It says we will be discussing the biggest rumours every week through the window. Will this window prove to be something specials and the dawning of a new era or a relative case of do nothing? By the way, if you didn't get that pun, we also lost Terry Hall of the Specials this Christmas. And I know that the Game Is About Glory was pretty upset about it, like many people. So that's both a tribute and it's also actually a serious question. From reading some of the aggregator accounts on Twitter, you could be forgiven for thinking that the lunatics have taken over the asylum. Oh, dear. Anyway, the loudest rumour at the moment seems to be our interest in Sporting Lisbon right-back Pedro Porro, which has been rumbling along for a few weeks now. Porro has a release clause of $45 million. This week's Sporting manager, Ruben Amorim, said, "I was told he can only leave if the clause is triggered. We know there's clubs who can pay it, but until that happens, he is safe." Milo, do you want to take this next paragraph?
I thought that was perfect for you, actually, but other players we've been linked with this
week. I'll do it. No, I can do it if you want. Sorry. I saw it's all the... Yes. Okay. Drum roll as I try and go through these names. Other players that we've been linked with this last week are, deep breath, Frank Kessie, Marlo Gusto, Vanderson, Ismail Assar. I don't know why I put an ish on that. He's not Dutch, is he? Ismail Assar, Harvey Barnes, Ruslan Malinovsky, Tete, Denzel Dumfries, Wilfried Zaha, Weston McKennie, and Martin Terrier. Other than that McLaren-esque Ismail Assar, I think I did quite well there. And finally, reports in Brazil say that Lucas Moura is in talks over a move back to his boyhood club, Sao Paulo. Right. I mean, where do we start this conversation? Because it's definitely taken on a different accent in light of the restart of the season. I suppose we should start with what would your priority be for the window? And should Conte be back? They almost seem like they're the same. They work off each other. Who wants to wrestle this beast? Milo, go first.
Go on, I'll dive in. So I think let's answer this on a continuity basis. So Conte staying around and is going to be around for the foreseeable in answering this, because I think, you know, he's got very specific demands from his squads. So the thing that we keep coming back to on this pod throughout the first half of this season has been the weakness or the lack of depth on the right hand side. We don't have a right wing back who particularly suits what Conte wants. Our understudies for Romero, none of them are particularly comfortable on the ball. And when Decky's out, we've looked short of ideas, as we'll go on to talk to. So my priority would be strengthening the right hand side, a first choice right wing back and suitable cover at right wing forward and right centre central defender, and preferably a right central defender who could also cover in central defence or also play there. So yeah, dream window that, and then someone who could play six or eight. If all of our Christmases really were coming at once, I suppose.
Yeah, not much more than that. I think I agree with the right wing back, the right centre back. Hopefully, if we can find one that can probably play centre back as well, and then the cover for Decky. And I presume that then means, in an ideal world, Jaff or Sanchez would go, or Jaff and Sanchez would go, Emerson or Doherty. And then if we've got the numbers, Hill, Sarr go on loan. And I presume, I don't think we're going to get rid of Moura, but I think he's just kind of winding down to leaving in the summer anyway. So I think he's in his last year, isn't he? So that would be the priorities, really. And that's without carrying on in mind what might happen in the summer when a whole shed load of players then come back to us that we have to think about, I suppose.
I suppose we don't know the details of Lucas's discussions with Sao Paulo. If it is for a transfer soonish, then you're going to need two forwards coming in if Hill is going out on loan. We couldn't, and I know Moura's barely been fit this season, but you only have to look at the bench today to see how threadbare we are with a handful of injuries up front. And that starts feeling like a bit of a tall order for a January window, which is always very difficult to bring players in.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you said about strengthening. I'm just going to add to it. I even if our forwards are fit, we need one more. I mean, for me, absolutely. We need to be able to rotate forwards who are being overused and somewhat out of form. We'll get into that a little later. Let me repeat the second part of that question, which is, should Conte be backed? I mean, it's not a simple question, is it? Is it, Milo? It's not at all.
The question I ducked, you mean? it's the elephant in the room, isn't it? It's, I think Conte has made this harder with some of his comments recently. I think he's slightly overplayed his hand. There are comments that we've heard from him before. He's done it every single window where he brings up his future and the weaknesses in the squad. I don't think anyone would argue with his assessment of where the squad is weak or where we're at. But he does have very, very specific requirements. And if he's calling into question, if he's not committed to the club, it's harder to spend that money when potentially you could have another manager coming in at some point who might not want the players that Conte wants. And I'm not quite sure where that leaves us.
I'd first say that I think backed's a horrible word. I hate the word backed because it's very binary. In other words, you're either doing that or you're not doing that. And I think
congratulations for the first binary of the new 2023. Fantastic. Well done, sir.
But because there's so many attributes and branches and alleyways and any other kind of way I could call it to sort of talk about. But I think the first starting place is that I think everyone knows what's been said, as in even behind closed doors. And I think the other thing just to say, first of all, is if any promises have been broken, then that's not happened because Conte just 100% wouldn't be here if any promises have been broken. That's my opening bit. Got plenty of other things to say probably, but go on.
For the sake of trying to keep this pod moving on in a live fashion and not force Milo to the edit, I'm going to work with a metaphor. As you both know, and as regular listeners know, these metaphors can be clunky. But try and go with me because it's springing in my head as I'm speaking it. Let's imagine that Daniel has managed to attract Sophia Loren in her prime to be his partner.
That's
and
quite the
has
picture.
Done so. What's that?
Have you been at the the AI writing tool for this as well?
You can be the judge of that in about a minute.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And maybe he said to Sophia, look, it's a little rough around the edges. I'm afraid that I can only bring you to dinner at Nando's for the next short while. But, trust me, if the film roles that you're getting pay off and we manage to, I managed to make a couple of good deals and whatever, soon we'll be able to go and dine, couple of good Michelin-style restaurants, and there will be no more Nando's. It'll be okay. Maybe the odd stop on a Friday night if we're stuck. But generally speaking, we're going to bump it up a bit. And maybe that's what's going on here. Maybe Sophia's finding out that her paramour is actually still convinced that he can get away with Nando's.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe Sophia has told him, hey, I'd love Nando's. That'd be great and fantastic. And maybe she's like not being flexible either. Maybe these are two very inflexible people.
I mean, it's... Yeah, Conte is serving up fried pigeon, isn't he? Not fried chicken. It's
Huey Levy is serving up fried. Right?
No.
Okay.
I think Conte has been given some fine ingredients, but he's not doing, certainly was in the summer, but isn't doing a lot with them.
I see.
Go on. I think we can talk about Conte, but just on the Levy point at the moment, because I don't 100% agree with Steph here. I just think that we've had reasons to gripe about Levy, but obviously he had his own kind of pathway he wanted to take. But in recent times, when we used to moan about these things, about holding on to players for too long, he started to pay off players to get rid of them. True? Aurier?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's happy to let players go for nothing. Dele and probably Winks and Moura will come on. He's employed a director of football to run the football side of the club. Mm-hmm. All wanted that, didn't we? And let him get on with it. And also, he's injected capital of 150 million to the club, which is almost unthinkable. And you would think that people that wanted Enoch out would think, you know, that's never going to happen. And these are observations and just, you know, they're observations basically based on things that have actually happened. So what I'm saying is we can think that Levy's not going to change. And to be honest, I think it's a bit disingenuous to say that Levy's not changed, because I think the financial footing and the foundation of the club's change, that's allowed Levy to change. I think to think that Levy changing is a bit dodgy, almost is a close cousin to the tropes that get thrown at him. So I think you have to be careful there. And he has changed. I mean, the actions of the club have changed in that point. So it then leads me to think, what are the other things you want layered on now beyond more money for him to do?
So if I can just step away from my somewhat absurd metaphor.
I like your metaphors, Seth. Never give up on them.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. I'll get there one day. And I'm sure I don't even know if an AI bot would have come up with that. But maybe at some point in the future, listeners will hear us type that into an AI, Daniel Levy, Sophia Loren, and we'll see what happens. But seriously, I think, first of all, and look, we shouldn't go down this road too far, I understand. I think you've made some excellent points. I would say that we probably need a little more information as to exactly where and what that 150 million was all about. It hasn't all been used in the end. That's a fact. So it hasn't, as of now, been spent. And I would agree. I mean, he has absolutely, he's a very, very, when he reacts to a situation, he reacts. But what we have to wonder is, in the end, whether it all returns to type. And that's what I wonder if we're seeing right now, because we do have this situation where we've got a director of football who needs support, and we've got a manager who needs support, and the signings don't quite seem to align with what the manager needs. And I'll hand the floor back before I get into a long-winded sort of ramble. Someone take that on.
But does it then just fall into, because I think he just basically sets the budget and Paratici then has the autonomy to do whatever he wants with that. In other words, we could buy a more expensive player, but then we wouldn't have much money to spend on other players. So obviously you've got a set limit. But do we then, I don't want to say this, but do we then fall into too dare is too dear? Is that where we end up?
And I love that phrase, to dare is too dear.
No, don't love that phrase, please, don't. Steph, because you're going to end up...
It is quite funny. I've never heard. I must be ignorant. My head's in the sand. Is this around or
We're going to see you walking off towards the black railings opposite the club shop next time you're at the lane if you pull into that too much. With a little banner on the wall. But please,
it's a good
don't
Caribbean
go there,
food stand over there, actually.
There is, actually. No.
So you're not wrong. I will be wandering over there soon.
The smell brings you into there, doesn't it? It's
good,
delicious.
Good music as well.
You're right.
Yeah. Top marks to them.
I mean, I think I agree with Ricky. I think, yeah, if there's an issue here, you'd have to question whether Paratici and Conte were on the same page necessarily, or whether Conte is just digging his heels in and being difficult. I think most of us thought at the end of the summer transfer window, you know, maybe with a question mark over Spence, but the rest of the business looked pretty solid and gave us depth that we hadn't had previously. And you know, I think we've got to be fair and say that at the moment we've got, you know, we've been a little unlucky with injuries, and we're missing some key players today that would have made a difference. But you know, I don't think Conte's made best use of what he had, even if it wasn't You know, let's be charitable and say, you know, maybe it wasn't exactly what he wanted, although he didn't criticize, you know, any of those players other than Spencer in the summer, and seemed quite happy with the business. And, you know, again, in terms of strategy, you know, if you look at Richarlison, you know, we went out and spent £70 million on a 25, 26-year-old player. That's not the kind of business we would have done previously. And, you know, that's a considerable amount of money.
I mean, I will say just on the Paratici thing quickly, and then you can have a shout, Steph, is that I do feel he might be, I mean, obviously he's been given a remit, and I think that in the early stage of it, he's definitely been pulled in sort of two directions somehow, because I think the club definitely want to do the Moneyball thing. I think that definitely wants to go on. And I think Conte's even all right with that, as long as it doesn't affect what he can have. You see what I mean? And maybe...
No, I think that is absolutely the problem. I think it's a massive problem, and I feel sorry for Paratici. And by the way, I've forgotten whether it was you or Milo that brought up, I think it might have been you, who said, you know, we have to remember that he's also probably dealing with some fallout from what's going on with this, you know, the legal case in at Juventus. Yeah, so,
true.
No, I think it's a massive problem. Yeah, huge.
But yeah, go on. Move on to Conte.
Let me maybe redefine that question so it's a little clearer. I mean, let's assume that, well, first of all, do we know what backing Antonio Conte means? And if we do we think he should be backed? Why don't we each take a crack at saying what we think backing Antonio Conte means? And then we can speculate as to whether he should be backed. Maybe that's
what, in our personal view, or what we think Conte thinks it means?
What we believe Conte thinks it means.
Well, I mean, the thing I was going to say about Conte is obviously other thing, you know, observations I get from this is that if it appears to me, and I don't want it to boil down to this, but it appears to me he's almost saying, I want a 40, 50 million pound player dropped into every position and then I'll make it work. You know what I mean? And I just think some people at the club might think, but I'm paying you 12, 15 million quid a year. And I could probably pay someone else a lot less and still get that to work, especially if you're looking about how the way it's working at the moment and the way it's going on. And I just think I think it's almost like, I always quite like teams, and they're a lot more kind of, you know, you have a lot more admiration for them when they're greater than the sum of their parts. Mm-hmm. And I think that Conte's teams look like they're the sum of their individual players and not, you know, greater than the sum of their parts. And it makes me wonder what he brings to the table beyond what he thinks his plan is. And the other problem I've got with his plan is that it's so much about the automations. It's so much about his way. It's so ingrained. It's so precise, so concise. And I think, as we said before, players aren't given autonomy, or they're not given, I think you said before, Milo, like freelancing, that if your plan's so rigid, it better bloody work, because you're going to take the blame for it if it doesn't. You know what I mean? And I think he's scared of failing because he does care about what people think about him. And I think that is actually a weakness when you worry too much about what people think about you. And I think that's quite... I've joked in the chat that even gets reflected in getting your hair done. I know that sounds a bit like stupid, but it does. He's worried about what people think about him. And he's a born winner. And I think the thing he might be struggling with is just the competitiveness of this league. To get this league won is a massive mountain to climb.
And you've got to bear in mind, is that, you know, since he came in, you've got Newcastle getting bought out, and them spending maybe not mega money yet, but still, you know, a lot more than they would have previously, and them kind of overperforming over that first year. So you know, a competitive league's got even more competitive. And you look at the table at the moment, and you know, I mean, one and two in the league look nailed on at the moment. You know, you could, which order that ends up in, who knows? That's for another discussion. But you know, three down to what, six in the league? You know, that you could throw a hat over them, couldn't you? There's it's so difficult there, and you've got a lot of teams competing for for two spots.
Okay, chaps, I'm going to go one more time with the question. Another metaphor for you. When we took on Antonio Conte, we took on a Michelin star chef who was known for making the best souffles you could possibly find. We've given him a refrigerator that doesn't quite have the top ingredients to make a Michelin star standard souffle. And if we want to buy the ingredients for it, it's going to cost a lot. However, we can make some world-class omelettes. So do we back him to be able to change his game, so to speak, the one that's got him to a Michelin star position and become an omelette chef as well? Or do we just say, you know, we may have actually got this a little wrong in the judgment call? Do we back him?
I mean, I think we've answered that. But I mean, I think in terms of kind of Conte, I think Conte's always been quite open about this being something that he thought was going to need several windows. So, you know, even in the summer, he was saying, you know, it's going to need, you know, another 2-3 windows in order to complete this and to have the team, you know, that he thinks can compete. And in terms of what he said about the kind of the club's strategy or the club's approach to transfers, I'd be amazed if that came as a surprise to anyone. I think, you know, in terms of, you know, what a Tottenham signing looks like, I think we all know that, don't we? I think we know that, you know, predominantly we're looking at players with a resale value, ideally, that we can, you know, can develop and sell on later on. And then, you know, with Conte there, I think, you know, we're kind of augmenting that with you know, players like Perisic or, you know, older, more experienced players to kind of complement that and help that through. Conte has appeared to be on board with that previously. And I've got to be honest with you, I don't really disagree with that as a strategy. I don't, you know, we're not in a position where we can go out and you know, spend a fortune and have, you know, 20 players on, you know, 200k a week. We're not in that position. So, you know, I don't really have a problem with that. But I think there's probably a question about whether, I mean, this goes back to something that you talk about, Ricky, a lot about kind of that synergy between the manager and the owners of the club and the fans and the players and all of that coming together. And I think there is a question as to whether Conte is the right fit for Spurs and, you know, the right fit for a club run by Enoch and all of that. And, you know, I don't know. And I don't know. Is there an issue between Paratici and Conte? I don't think so, but it's difficult to say, isn't it? We haven't seen Paratici speak for a while, and I don't know.
I mean, and you added another one that we're now prepared to do, which is to buy older players and play them, you know, even if they're free transfers, but give them like big money contracts. We're not too fussed about that, and we wouldn't do that before. But I just think mainly
we did buy Fernando Llorente. I mean, I know the point you're trying to make, but we have done it before. But I know the point you're making.
I think Perisic's probably on more money than him, though, weren't he? Perisic is 200k, probably.
Yeah, he's going to be one of the higher earners, isn't he?
Yeah, so anyway. But, I mean, by the by. But I just think, so really, the segment, and we're quite happy to buy 40, 50, nearly £60 million players as well. And I think, so it only leaves really expensive players that we're not willing to buy, like in that category. And I'm sure if the right person, as I said before, I'm sure if we had a big chunk of money, but that's all we could buy and it was the right player, a bit similar to as we talked before about Van Dijk coming to Liverpool and that kind of thing, I'm sure we would do that if we thought it was the player we needed. But I just think that the problem I've got is then if Conte isn't happy with that, then I just think it reflects on him. I mean, he could be, is Eddie Howe putting him to shame? Does he want to work with Dan Burn? Does he want to work with Wilcox? Does he want to work with Chris Wood? Does he want to work with St. Maximin, one good game in five? He's got Almiron playing as good as Kulusevski. Wow.
The truth of the matter is that our fans would have been in uproar if we'd appointed Eddie Howe, you know, just over a year ago, wouldn't they? You know, he's done a fantastic job.
But we're back. Yeah, Eddie Howe has done a fantastic job, by the way, as is Erik ten Hag is doing a good one at Man United. We were discussing that off pod. But look, I mean, to get back to my second analogy there, which I actually thought was pretty accurate. I'll put my head on the block here because I don't think either of you are particularly willing to do so. I think the way the situation is set up, this is a Michelin star chef who came in, as I said, a souffle maker. That's what he does. That's what he needs. Those are the ingredients he wants. Every year he wants to improve on the best ingredients you can get to make a best souffle you can have. And I don't think he's prepared to work with omelettes. Now, where the breakdown in communication is and whose fault that is, I don't know. But I think it's cruel on a Michelin star chef to keep on telling him to make omelettes at this point. And I think it's cruel on the supporters of the club to have us expecting Michelin star food. So I think personally that we should probably not be backing him in the way that he wants ingredients in the fridge, because inevitably it feels to me, this is very personal, that it is not going to work. By God, I want to be wrong. I want to know that he can make brilliant omelettes with wonderful fresh ingredients. But I don't think it's going to happen. There's a weird, we talked about weather storms around the club. There's two different storms brewing, it seems, in two different areas. And it just doesn't seem that we're going to be able to get out. So personally, I would be backing the club vision right now because it's the one that we're going to end up doing anyway. So why do this dance? That's what it feels like to me.
I mean, I think it does come back to that. You know, if we've got a project on our hands, if it is something that's going to take, you know, another 3-4 windows, is Conte going to be around at the end of that? Is he, you know, he's a here and now manager who you know needs good players in order to for his system to work, and it's beginning to feel like a project. And is he, you know, is he the right fit for the job?
I mean, I do think, I mean, the finance levels, as I've explained, I think we are giving managers, and we have given. And the other thing I will say on Conte's side is he's right when he's saying is that we are buying players, but we can't make mistakes. And of course, we went for a big period of making mistakes with all those out. And they're mistakes we've got to pay for. We're not like, you know, we've not got oil money. We can't do that at all. And I think he needs, but I think he gets back to a high level. I think the thing that stresses him out is he thinks he needs more just because of the sheer competitive of the league. If you want to overtake, then the problem you've got, and the conflict we've got is if you want to overtake Liverpool and Man City, make up 20 points a year, the reason Enoch won't necessarily go that far is because the other thing they've always said is I will not jeopardise the future of this club and that. And I think if you built something over 20 years, you know, I could possibly feel the same. I don't want that undermined because I mean, to look at it another way, I tell you, you can phone your Everton friends, you can phone your, you know, you can phone your Sheffield Wednesday friends, you can phone your Forest friends, you can phone all them teams and think, would you swap places with us? And they would say, yeah, no doubt. You know, with the setup you've got and stuff like that, you're a load nearer to doing anything we have. And the the opposite to that is Man City, Newcastle or Chelsea friends might ask me, would I swap places with them? And I'd say no, because I don't want that. So really, I'm left with a shitly run Man United that I might want to swap places with. The only team I'd probably consider swapping places with situation-wise would be Liverpool, and that would be it. So I have to look at it in those terms.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you talk about kind of spending, you look at how much Chelsea has spent over the last couple of windows and, you know, the business that it looks like they're queuing up for January, and they're behind us in the league. And, they don't look in any better a position than we are. And, no, I mean, in terms of this season. And I think, you know, from Enoch's point of view, that, you know, we were, what, second best team in the country in the run-in last season, or, you know, in the league in the run-in last season. You know, they spent 100 million in the summer, and, you know, other than, who do we say, Bentancur and Kane, everyone else has gone backwards this season. There isn't, you know, much sign of an improvement. And I think it comes back to the point you're making though, Steph, you know, can Conte play through this? You know, there's definitely an issue with, you know, with his, you know, souffles when you've got, you know, Jaffa or Sanchez or Royale, you know, in the side and they can't play through a press, they can't pass out. That's definitely an issue. But I think there's also a case that actually some of our automations are looking a little predictable. I think teams know how we're going to try and play through them and are closing that down well. You know, if you look at the Brentford game, and say I'm doing my usual habit here of trying to mix up all the games and make it impossible for us to go through and talk about matches. But in that Brentford game, Brentford were very, very quick to second balls. You know, they were hoofing it forwards and then pressing us and closing us down, and we couldn't play through it. We didn't know, you know, we didn't know how to do it. It becomes an issue if he's demanding the best ingredients, but he's not actually improving what he's got. You know, things don't appear to be getting better. It's an issue.
What I will say that's consistent between what happened with Antonio Conte last season, getting us into the Champions League, and what happened with Maurizio Pochettino over a four season stretch, is both exceeded their expectations mm-hmm. early on. And I, unfortunately, am increasingly of the opinion that people then continue to expect rabbits to come from hats, mm-hmm. regardless of what's going on around them. And I think that attitude needs to change at the club, and you need to have a little more respect for who is doing what. I don't disagree. I do think that there is a problem when you consistently only play one system in automations. But equally, we have to know who we've got into bed with. I think they're complicated issues, and there's no straightforward answer to either of them, which is why this conversation, we should probably bring it to a close, because we're probably going to end up having it again next week and the week after and the week after. But I mean, I think, you know, at the very least, what I was hoping we'd be able to do with this section, and I think we've managed to do very well, is make it clear that this is not just about one person or one party. It's about how these things work together. And there is, you know, there's fault and expectation and praise to be had all around. But right now, it's a multi-pronged issue. And, I don't know if anyone has an answer. I think we're all looking for one. That's worrying.
We are looking for an answer, and it is worrying.
And everyone's frustrated. I'm frustrated. I was as angry today as I've been for a long time. But it's not going to change what the situation is. And this is a storm. We're in the middle of one.
I think what's difficult is that, you know, we talk about, you know, what Arteta's doing at Arsenal. I do think that a lot of the unease at Spurs is because, or, you know, amongst our fan base is because the lot down the road are doing well at the moment. And that kind of compounds a difficult situation and makes it worse. But if you look at what happens at Arteta, you know, Arteta's been given a lot of time at Arsenal. He's been allowed to bomb out big name players who he didn't want. He's pretty much been given a free rein to reshape the squad. You know, you look at what Klopp did at Liverpool again. That took a while for him to build what he had there. And you know, in terms of, you know, central defence, it took a while to get in what he needed. And, you know, are we being jittery and shooting ourselves in the foot when, you know, if you stick to the plan, you know, there's a plan here. The manager's always said it's going to take a number of windows to get there. You know, there's highs and lows along the way. Do we need to see this through?
Yeah, because this is the thing I was going to say that, especially about the Klopp thing, because I get the feeling he hasn't really got the patience that he's always banging on about. That's my hunch, really. And I think, but in this league, you are going to need it. I think it's just not, it's not going to happen in a season. And as you said, I think Klopp's proven that. And I just think,
I think Klopp's been sensational.
But it took him a while, didn't it, to get through the thing. And it just, you know, to get Liverpool on the upgrade.
Yeah. But and look, without, again, I don't want to get too much into history, but my jitters, and I'll just talk very personally, my jitters right now are as much based on the fact that when we were ahead of these clubs and when we were ahead of this pack, when we did have the progressive manager who was hamstrung by being homeless for a season and a half, who literally didn't get, he got pennies to the pound, literally. And then when he was finally backed, we pulled the plug after 3 months. I mean, one of the most disastrous pieces of like sort of PR patchwork versus long-term planning, I think you've seen in any business. It was absurd. I think we've got a right to be a little concerned about this. And once again, as we've all been saying for half an hour, this man makes a dish, you know? So I look. Yeah, I mean, and the Arsenal situation was brought up. That's not a concern to me. It is what it is. But I understand that what you're saying is that for the fan base, it is a major concern and it doesn't help. Lots of storms, as you said, and to be discussed in the coming weeks, I'm sure.
And on the discussion on the chat the other day when I think it was Armour saying, you know, he's really concerned about kind of the reaction from Arsenal fans if they win the league. I'm more worried about the reaction from Spurs fans if they win the league. You know, it's like...
Well, you know, stupidly, and I'll throw this in and then we will move on to today's game. Stupidly, I started to get a little glum thinking, well, they are playing well. They're playing great football. You can't argue. And they do have a shallow squad or bubbly, 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 bar. But of course, then ding, my little like optimistic light bulb went off and I was like, well, why don't we just go and win the Champions League? Which brings us to today's home game against Aston Villa. Thanks very much, lads, by the way, for talking through that tricky field of pachyderms, if you will. And I'm sure we'll be doing more of it in the weeks to come. But yeah, from dreaming of winning in Istanbul this summer to the Villa at home. I mean, it's a natural segue, isn't it? Isn't it? No? Okay, all right. No, it isn't.
More eggs than omelettes, I think, Steph.
Excellent, very good, you've cracked the code. Scrambling as I was to try and make that segue, let's just be blunt. Team selection, chaps, let's just start there. The team selection for today's game against Aston Villa at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which was 2-0.
I mean, obviously the big shock was Deki being out, and I think Dyer sitting this one out was quite heavily trailed. I think it was, you know, pretty much expected by the time the team was announced. So, yeah, Hill in for Deki was the surprise. I was quite excited to see Hill on the team sheet. I thought he'd done okay in the friendlies, near mid-season friendlies, and I've been a little frustrated about his lack of opportunities in the first half of the season. And I really hoped that that he would stake a claim and show us that we didn't need to go out and spend a load of money in January in order to get a Deki understudy, because we had one in the squad already staring us in the face. And he didn't do a lot to live up to that. So, yeah.
Yep, I had no disputes with the lineup, really. Nice to see, not nice to see, but it's interesting to see Doherty still getting the shout on the right. And I think he probably, I don't know what that means for Emerson, but I think he's definitely trying to get Doherty back to some of that kind of consistency and form that he was, you know, congratulating him with last year. So before the injury, ironically, against Villa. But yeah, Loris is back. Good thing. probably. And Sonny keeps trying. Kane keeps trying. And then Bissouma tries to keep improving. And Pierre just carries on doing what he's doing in the middle there. So I can't see what other changes he could have made, really, to be honest. But I agree with Milo. Good to see Hill there. I think he's stylistically the best player to come in for Deki. You could probably argue maybe the only player really now that can come in for Deki. So, but yeah, and I think we'll get to, you know, how we played in that in a moment.
Yeah, I'm going to skip the selection because it's going to come up in the next part of our conversation as to how I felt about the selection. I mean, needless to say, when I looked at the subs bench, I grimaced. I really did. I mean, I'm sorry. If you wanted an example of why I think we need to be a little more active in this window, that it was right there. So injuries notwithstanding. So, I mean, look, how did we play? I mean, these are simple questions on the face of it when we write them, but they're really not that simple, are they? Or maybe it was today, because I thought, and I'll start, I thought we were flat, largely uninspired. Even when it looked like we were building ahead of steam, it wasn't really enough to make a really brimmingly hot cup of tea, was it? It was still a little below boiling point.
Yeah, I mean, I thought we shaded the first half, but it shaded rather than clearly better. I thought Villa were, you know, very well organised. They were defending with, you know, six men back there. There was very little space for us to get through. And then, you know, without that creativity in the side, it was very, very difficult to find a way through that. And that showed, you know, and you kind of, in the first half, you're thinking, well, probably our best chance of scoring is getting a set piece somewhere, you know, around the box or, you know, a corner or something like that and something happening. But, you know, Vio's magic wasn't evident today at all. We you know, wasted the chances we did get. And, you know, we're almost reliant on that against teams that sit back against us. I went into the second half, you know, feeling reasonably optimistic because I thought we had ended the first half a bit brighter. And I thought, you know, if we got a goal, then Villa would have to open up a bit and then maybe something happens. And, you know, you're almost looking for something to happen to kickstart our season and get us going. You know, we'd made excuses repeatedly during the first half of this season thinking, well, he's biding his time to the World Cup. You know, we've got fixture congestion. It's difficult. You can't work with the players. Well, he's had 6 weeks to work with most of these players. We've come out, you know, after Christmas and we don't look any better. The same problems are there. It doesn't look like he's changed anything or, you know, worked out new ways around some of the issues we've got. And yeah, you know, we just feel like a team that's without Deki there. There's, you know, with Kane, you know, if Kane's not on form, then there's no one there who can create anything unless it's from a set piece and you know, then Sonny or Perisic come into play.
I'd add to that I think obviously Sonny is off form, let's face it. And I think, and that doesn't help Kane because obviously they're partners in crime. They've had such a great relationship over these seasons. So if one of them's certainly playing as flat as Sonny is, then that's going to affect Kane as well. But that's the problem, I think. That transition to the forwards is once Sonny's touch is terrible. Things bounce off him. He had a couple today where there was one that bounced off him outside the area where he could have taken a shot. The 4-yard pass to Kane is just like the simplest ball in the world, really, because he had time and space to play it. And Hill is obviously doesn't seem physically strong enough, but I did feel a bit sorry for him because I think we should just have laid it into him more. His movement's really good. We should have just laid it into him more when he's in that position between their left back and their left centre half, because he'll get it sometimes out on the touchline. But sometimes he's a bit then too far out. I think in that smaller gap, he might be a bit more deft with his touch and be able to create something. But that wasn't really happening. I think, as Gareth said in their chat, it seemed like they were reluctant to pass to him for some reasons and that kind of thing.
He played for me, Brian Hill, like a player who was fighting for a chance and who knows that the manager doesn't really believe in him and is not actually probably going to react positively whatever happens. Given who he's replacing, and it really felt that was sort of the caliber of performance he gave. Bless him, I couldn't fault him, but I think it's a fait accompli, isn't it? Really,
That's happened in other cameos as well when he's played. He's doing exactly like you say, Steph.
Yeah, and I also think that for some reason we are just completely bereft and unable to try and find an early ball when someone is running right now. And you know, I counted four times that Doherty made a dart behind to try and get him behind. Just it was either ignored or not seen. As for Harry, I feel very sorry for him. I mean, you have to give him the ball a little more than we're giving it to him, albeit he was rusty today. My big concern with Sonny is that he looks like he has genuinely lost a yard of pace. He just doesn't look as fast. And I don't know if this is because he's off form or if because physics and are taking their toll. But he looks like a man who needs a proper recharge. And as for Bissouma, I'm sorry, I just don't see it.
And I mean, with Sonny, his game's always relied on pace. You know, he's not a link player. He's not someone who can play with his back to goal and bring others in. Absolutely. It's just not there. So, you know, if his pace is going, then I'm not sure he's going to be able to adapt his game. And
he did have a bit of a foot race with Ashley Young today and didn't really make much impression on him when the ball was going back towards Villa's goal. And Ashley Young's 38, so...
Right. Yeah. It was a concern to me that in general. Personally, and I'm not just saying this because I'm a fan of Eric Dyer's. I freely admit that we need to upgrade on him at this point. You know, to double down, it would be ludicrous because he's obviously, if we want to actually win trophies, we are going to have to upgrade. But I don't think any defensive combination we have right now can afford to be without him if we're playing in a three, even though he's off form. And I concede his mistakes, you know, have been very poor. I think the one at Brentford was possibly overplayed in context, but we'll get into that later. And I felt we missed him today on both goals. I thought at least one of them you would have seen him diving in to prevent. I mean, look, it's all hearsay. Who knows?
I thought leaving Dyer out was a kindness, and because it is feeling a bit toxic around the club at the moment, and I think there's a risk that people might have turned on him because he is coming in for a lot of flack from
certain sections of the fan base.
I also think that if we're to get anything out of this season, we need Dyer on form, and I think maybe him taking a couple of weeks off, and you know, I wouldn't play him against Palace in midweek. I wouldn't play him against Portsmouth, and I'd want to bring him back in for the North London derby. That's the way I'd be looking at it. And I think earlier in the season, if we think when Sonny was struggling at the beginning of the season and Conte tried to play him through that patch, and you know what he ended up doing was dropping Deki and playing Richarlison on the right-hand side, which didn't work. And I think really what was staring us in the face then was to let Sonny sit out a few weeks, play Richarlison, and then let Sonny come off the bench. Yeah. I see a similar situation here where you've got a player in a funk and you know, maybe just needs to be taken out of the spotlight, get a bit of a breather, and then hopefully come back stronger. You've got to say that after Conte came in, Dyer was, you know, from that point to the end of the season, and actually right the way up until he got his England recall, has been one of our best players. Mm. And you know, Conte was talking about making him one of the best kind of central centre backs in the world. And he got recalled for England, his form has nosedived.
Yeah. I was really hoping with Dyer that obviously being away with England, because he obviously had problems as well before he went away to World Cup, with being away to with the World Cup, and obviously he's probably had a bit of time since he's come back. I'm not sure what time the England boys, how much time they had off. And I just thought a change would have been as good as a rest. And we're going to move on to the Brentford game. It's just sad that something like that happened in the Brentford game, really. Mm. Because it didn't sort of draw a line under it, did it? It was just a shame.
Well, chaps, in this pachyderm-packed pod, let's move to Hugo Lloris. I mean, what is there to say? It's another gaffe. I mean, it's a clanger.
I think you're having a similar conversation to we're having about Sonny. You know, is it terminal? Because the clangers are becoming a habit, and you know he's not where he was. We all know that he's going to need to be replaced sometime in the next, well, you know, he's not going to get another contract extension, is he? And it's becoming a habit.
Mm. I mean, I know he didn't really have much to do up to that point, I don't think. I mean, I don't think their XG would have been that high up to the point they scored, because they weren't giving us any problems. But the main concern with it was obviously we talked about stuff at half time, and we really did come out in the second half there and looked like we were stepping it up like we have done in other kind of second halves. And just the moment that happened, I mean, when he spilled it, it was, you know, it was like Exxon Valdez problems, really, a spill of that quantity. You know what I mean? It really did put, you know, drown us in oil, basically, after that. And there was no way back. There was no way back. It was just... And that's hard for him. It's hard for him to accept. And I know I think he's another one that takes these things quite personally, and he beats himself up about it. But,
Yeah, I mean, I suppose now we'll move on to, I mean, you know, we could carry on deconstructing what was an immensely disappointing performance today. I think we probably should put the handbrake on that a little bit. All being said, we should, you know, what do we think of Aston Villa? I'll kick off by saying that I felt that they were, you know, a well organized average side of the caliber that we should be beating at home. Mm-hmm. That's my feeling, and they did nothing in the game to show me otherwise. And in the end, my biggest disappointment of all was that I was left thinking, if they didn't faff around as much as they did, they would have easily got a third goal. There were two opportunities they had to score a third goal, and they kind of faffed it on themselves. And that's immensely disappointing to me, because I don't think they're that good. They're a thorough mid-table side for me.
Yeah, I thought they were really well organised and took their chances, but you know, the first chance we gave them on the plate, and our confidence looked shot after going behind.
In comparison with our own manager, like, who's, I mean, that's the other thing we need to say. I mean, it seems like a long year, but he has only been here a year. And the same with Emery, really. He's on an early journey with Villa. I think they've got some players to work with. I think, you know, he's got, you know, he's got some people on the bench as well that aren't that bad of players. And
their bench looked better than ours today.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you brought those other players on, when Ings could come on, and
Coutinho,
the bloke played for Southampton, he was coming on. Matty Ings. Cash came on. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what I mean. So it's early days for Emery, and I quite like him as a manager. I think he got a tough time a bit at Arsenal, but he's a character, isn't he? And he did well when he went back to Spain and that, so
yeah,
you quite knock it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, closing thoughts, one positive and one negative in 30 seconds on today's defeat at home to Aston Villa, chaps. 3-2-1. Oh, go on, Ricky.
Positive was, I was nice to see Romero back on the field. I think he is really great. I think he actually had a good game today. I mean, beyond the kind of, you know, treading the line like he does with the yellow cards and various things like that. I think the negative was, I don't know, it continued, it just... around the match, it just continues to be sunny, I think. I just can't believe the drop-off after the winning the golden boot, really. And I was hoping when he demasked himself, it was going to be like in Scooby-Doo at the end. Do you want to take the mask off? And the real Sonny is back, that kind of thing. Yeah. I thought it was almost going to be like that moment where you thought, this is really going to be a turning point.
I think he thought it was going to be the way he threw that thing. He was like, fuck this, I've had enough of this encumbrance.
Because realistically, he could be going against medical advice there. You never know. He might have just ripped that off and just thought, I'm not having this anymore. It's hindering me or something.
I think it was affecting his peripheral vision, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure who it was. Someone came in and challenged him from the side, and I don't think he saw it until late. And I think at that point he thought, I need to be able to see around me.
Yeah. But it didn't seem to work, whatever he did. So
I've got to be honest with you, I'm struggling with the positive for this one. I can't really think of many. I mean, we didn't concede in the first half. Is probably about as good as I can do.
Yeah.
But the negative is just, we've covered this kind of amply in the kind of Conte, Enoch Paratici transfer window discussion earlier on. There's a, you know, kind of real kind of bad feeling around the club at the moment, and you know, the fans are getting restless, and you know, there's protests and things like that, and I'm not sure any of that stuff is going to help us get out of the mess we're in at the moment, but I can also understand the frustration. So it's a real it's difficult to see a way out of the hole we're in at the moment.
The positive for me was, even though he was only on the pitch for about 6 minutes, was Papamatsar, who I believe Milo is telling me has gone to Papsar, how he's now referred to. So Papsar, I thought he, in his cameo, looked so assured and so comfortable, really fluid, and to me has really accelerated himself past Oli Skip and past, in my opinion, my negative, which was Yves Bissouma. I'd have him playing ahead of Yves Bissouma from now on. Why not? I thought Bissouma was terrible today, to be honest. I thought, once again, he was caught sleeping in terms of tracking a man for a goal that we conceded. And I just am not seeing enough from him. It's simply not good enough to me. And it's a shame. Look, maybe he's going to come good, you know, after 8 months or a year, and maybe we'll look back at this and he'll be like, my first year, the horror year or whatever, who knows. But right now, to me, he's just not bringing it, you know.
I mean, you'll get to see someone else on Wednesday because he's suspended now. So someone will get their chance. It'll probably be Skip. I mean, the other problem with him being suspended is if he wanted to go back to a three in midfield because we haven't got people up, because Kulusevski, let's say, is still out, if he just wants to run with Sonny and Kane, then even on Wednesday, we'd be then left with Saar, Pierre and Skip to do that. So it's a tricky time, really, from that point of view.
It's a tricky time. And look, I think, you know, the other negative, I echo you with Sonny and Kane in a sense. Today was a day where I felt that I was, look, you never write off Harry Kane because he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And if he does leave at the end of the season and goes to Bayern or wherever he goes, he's going to continue to score a hatful of goals, whatever. So you don't write off. But what was sad today was seeing that partnership struggle so much, whether for lack of service or lack of performance from Sonny or whatever. And I'm not saying whose fault it is or whether these have become terrible players. And nothing to do with that. It was just sad today to see two strikers who you would have considered the best, two of the best forwards in the world over the last like six seasons, and you just can see that they're just off the pace with each other and in general out of step with what's going on around them on the pitch, or the team are out of step with them. And that's a little sad, because I still feel that if you give Harry Kane three chances, he's going to score one of them. And I mean, that's not rocket science, is it? Statistics tell us that. So yeah, anyway. And earlier in the week, we played Brentford. I'm not sure it was... We got 45 good minutes there, I think. Yeah. Maybe 60 if we're being charitable. How did you feel about how we played overall that night, champs?
Considering it was the first game back after a break and we maybe have been trying other things with the players that remained, it was almost kind of normal service resumed, basically, with the first half. And it was just... And then in the second, people say we're turgid and that kind of thing, but I don't always buy into that. I just don't think we're doing that well, because during the phases where we do well in the game, we're certainly not turgid. We're quite dynamic and we try and like attack. We do plenty of attacking. We create chances and we really go after a team. But it just seems as though we need to be cajoled into that. In other words, we need some kind of adversity to like respond to. And then we show some kind of resilience. But it's a real bizarre pattern we've got ourselves into, and it's almost a bit, I think it's quite, the levels we're doing it now, it's almost quite rare in football, I think, to think that something just chugs along, keep doing this same bloody thing every week. And I just don't know what the answers are, but you would hope some answers were forthcoming or some change or something. And it might carry on, Milo.
I in terms of the game, I mean, you know, Jaffet starting was a surprise, although he played on the right of defence in the friendlies we'd had prior to the season restarting. It had been Sanchez who'd been playing centrally whilst, you know, the international players were out of contention. I was surprised to see Jaffet in the starting lineup, and I think it's probably unlikely that we're going to see him there too many times again, if ever. It was a real performance to forget, and, you know, you can give him some mitigation for not having played in the first team for a while, but it was he was really poor, and it really impacted us, because, you know, Dyer was having to get closer to him in order to cover the space there. Brentford were, you know, just said earlier on, you know, they're punting it long, waiting for, you know, and then pressing our defenders for second balls, and we were getting a lot of joy off Jaffet, and the defence just looked really short of confidence. And I think, you know, in terms of what happens when we go behind, I think we do let the shackles off, don't we? And then we attack players and we play with a bit more freedom. Plan A definitely isn't working.
It's really strange, isn't it? What was this? The ninth game? It's been nine games in total
we've
gone behind, if we include today's game against Aston Villa, right? Is it nine?
Ten.
Did you say
ten. It was nine after Brentford, ten today.
I mean, you know, this is another Pachyderm moment in this pod, isn't it? I mean, what the hell do we think is going on? I mean, and you know, you can talk about the players, and we can talk about Tanganga, who it was very sad because I love Jaffet, but he's not a standard. It's just not. I mean, it's a shame to say it, but you know, what is going on? Why are we? I mean, Conte can't. What is Conte doing to address that problem?
I think this does come down to your souffles, Steph, in that, you know, we're the plan is, you know, Conte's plan, and he doesn't really deviate from this. is to try and draw teams onto the defense and then play through them. And they're playing, you know, the plan is to play through them with, you know, quick, you know, automation. So, you know, pre-planned routines to pass through a team and then attack into the space that's left behind. And to do that, you have to have players who are comfortable on the ball. And, you know, Jaffa isn't, you know, isn't a quick, incisive passer. He's not comfortable receiving balls under pressure and playing through that. On top of that, I think teams have sussed out those some of those patterns and are closing those down. And, you know, we saw that with Brentford closing down second balls and not allowing us to play through them. And you know, that lack of variety makes us easy to plan to play against. I think Frank said before the game that he'd guess 10 of the 11 players, and obviously they'd had all of their players at home during the World Cup. They had time to plan for this game, and it showed. You know, it was a good game plan. I thought they had.
I mean, that is a worry, though, isn't it? Because if you do literally play one way, it's not going to be long before you kind of other teams come to the conclusion without much kind of thought or study how to like combat you and play against you. It's just, I think that's almost, it almost sounds as though you'd get away with that in a league where no games were televised and stuff like that. And, you know, no one had any information on you. But after a while, you're just, people are going to combat that. They're not asleep, these people, are they? You know what I mean?
If you think back to Mourinho, though, when we, you know, the plan was for the Kane dropped deep and he swung the ball out for Son to run out onto, which worked really well for a few weeks, didn't it?
Yeah.
And then everyone doubled up on Kane and tracked him around the place and cut off supply. And then there was nothing there, was there? And this doesn't feel entirely dissimilar to that. If you stop us playing out from the back, and particularly if Decky's not playing, there ain't a lot there.
No. It just goes to prove, doesn't it, that it's, you know, football is never quite as complicated as we assume it is. And some of the things that we think are obvious. and it just doubles down on the question, like, why, knowing that, I mean, you know, do we continue to persist? Do we continue to bang our first half heads into the wall?
But I think if you go back to that question we had at the beginning, when we were saying about, you know, players coming in or what our priority positions are, you put a right centre back in there who can cover for Romero. You put a right wing back in there who can cross the ball and can carry the ball and get past, you know, beat a man and can play out. You give us cover for Decky, or you've got a ball playing, you know, central midfielder who can give us other ways of progressing the ball forwards and other patterns we can have for playing out of defence. Then we're a different proposition. And, I mean, you know, go on.
I was going to say, the other thing worth looking at, I think I said this in the chat, is we definitely went through a good phase last year where we were saying the opposite about this, where defensively we looked absolutely solid. And I'm not sure whether that's because we were regularly playing Romero, Dyer and Davis or Longley, and we just looked, teams just got no joy from us. And then we played out from there. But I think the other thing that might be the issue there, and so I think this is the other thing which Conte has an advantage with, is when we're just, and that might be because we're on the one game a week as well.
Yeah.
That's the other massive thing, I think, that he always goes on. I mean, we kind of joked about it when he joined, that he can't do two games a week, but it was almost like some of the evidence last year has proved that to be correct. And I think, I mean, the only problem with that is, I think if you're going to be a top six team in England, you're going to be playing two games a week. You know what I mean? So it's quite hard to get out of that.
I suppose the other thing is,
you've got a bigger squad, and then you can just keep, you know, your main players for the league games and things. So,
but Conte doesn't really rotate, so I think even if you gave him a bigger squad, he'd still be hammering the first, you know, his first choice 11.
Yeah, possibly. And I think this is where we talk about, and Milo, you were talking about, you know, the protest groups not being helpful and so on and so forth, and as understandable as it is, and look, we can debate the humanity or lack of behind all of these issues, but the facts are that when you only have a finite amount of players that a manager trusts, those players are being flogged, not rotated, and maybe there is a loss of form, and maybe there is a loss of confidence. That form and confidence becomes ever more fragile and ever harder to repair if it's consistently put in the spotlight in the way that recently this team and some of these players have been. And, you know, we go back to the point that you made earlier, Milo, about Eric Dyer's non-inclusion against Aston Villa. I was upset for my, you know, thinking that we'd lost some leadership and so on. But, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe that is player protection. And you know, but it's a shame when we have to protect these players as much as we do have to. And it seems to be an issue right now because there are a lot of players whose confidence is shaky. And maybe it's like a bug that you almost catch, that they can't get out of this negative spiral of starting games so slowly because they're not confident and because, you know, and it's how you snap that. But it is an issue.
And I think particularly if, you know, with the automations, you need to be committed to them. You need to be confident. Yeah. You need to be confident in the player who's receiving the ball. You need to be confident in the player who's playing the ball to you. And if they're not inch perfect, they're not going to come off because that gives the opponent time to get onto you. The whole idea of this way of playing is that because you're not thinking about it, you can move quicker than the opposition.
Hmm. Which plays into something we've been talking about all season, which is that our touch has been off. Our passes have been lax.
I mean,
our first touch has not been great for since the beginning of the season. And so, and by what you're saying, which is absolutely right, there's not really margin for that.
And, you know, against Brentford, it didn't help that they've been playing rugby on the pitch and it was churned up and in really poor condition. Right. And if you're trying to play the ball along the ground 2 feet for quick passing, that really doesn't help. Whereas if you're hoofing the ball in the air and then coming, you know, closing down for second balls, obviously it's a lot better for that.
And as to the confidence issue, which I think we're all agreeing on, I mean, you know, that we Longley gets pushed up a little more in the second half, starts playing a couple of those balls. One of those balls goes in out of nowhere. Harry Kane scores an excellent header. And suddenly our tails are up.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully, because of the rugby union there, we can see that he's just inside the 22-metre line. So we know exactly where he is when he plays it.
Fair play to Longley and Perisic on that side. They were really a threat from, they were putting great delivery. I mean, I thought actually Perisic today was a bit off with his delivery, or maybe he didn't have as many chances to deliver, but they They really turned it up in that second half against Brentford, which unfortunately then meant we were a bit more left-sided when I'm always kind of feeling we just need to get Deki involved in the game as much as possible, you see, because I just think he creates so well. But maybe we just need to do both sides. You know, we need to just keep, you know...
Well, I mean, once Sanchez came on, Deki came into the game even more.
I mean, I thought Deki and Doherty were linking up quite well in the second goal, where you've got that lovely interplay where it's Deki to Doherty, Deki to Højbjerg, the shot in, and it's kind of that trademark Deki run along the goal line and then cut back into the box. Yeah. And Højbjerg's run for that was so clever because everyone else was going towards the ball and he just stopped and held back and created the space for him. He read that so well.
A cool finish as well.
Yeah, it was a lovely finish, wasn't it?
Yeah.
At 1-1, we saw, I think, a fairly pivotal point in the game. We saw a VAR decision for a penalty not given on Harry Kane, who, given that we've talked about rugby on the pitch, I think that we saw a move on Kane that was fitting of the rugby that has been played on that pitch. I mean, is that one of the worst uses of VAR that we've seen this season?
I don't think you can blame VAR. I think you've got to blame the on-field ref. I mean, they're the one who got he's the person who got it wrong. But I mean, I was wondering whether the ref was confused about the rugby, saw the markings, and thought, yeah, that's fair. And it was completely wrong. It was Ben Mee, wasn't it? It was all over him and pulled him down. I mean, the thing with VAR is the guidance basically is if the ref sees it, then they side with the on-field decision because there's clashes.
It has to be a certain level for them to even look at it. But I think
that's where I'm confused, and maybe you can help me out. I thought that there was, and again, I always get this wrong, so I put my hand in the air. I might have this wrong, and I'm up to be corrected. But if VAR think that you've made a mistake, are they not compelled to say you should just go and take a quick look at the monitor just to be sure you've got the decision right?
And I mean, this is where it would be really helpful to hear the conversation between the ref and the VAR ref, because if the on-field ref, with clashes in the box, basically VAR isn't going to overturn it. If the ref saw it, they're unlikely to overturn it. They're going to stick with the on-field decision. So if the ref says, yeah, I saw it, I think that, you know, I saw that Ben Mee had his hands around Kane, but I was satisfied that it wasn't enough to bring him down, VAR is unlikely to overturn that or tell him to go and have a look at it. Yeah. And I think, you know, this is where you need to be able to hear what they're saying. But I also think there's a case for saying actually that this is the wrong way round at the moment, because the bar for a VAR intervention here is probably too high. And maybe what you need instead is the ref asking the VAR ref what they see. So, you know, if you had the on-field ref saying, I saw him come down, I saw that there was contact, but I'm unable to tell whether it was sufficient to bring him down or not. Could you tell me what you can see? Yep. Then that's a different like bar that. To clear.
No, honestly, no, that's great.
Taxi for Milo to Bletchley Park. Get down there now, Milo.
No, that's great.
Honestly,
no,
that just makes complete sense. Honestly, that really does make complete sense.
And particularly if you can hear that then.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, I think on-field refs aren't making decisions because they think VAR will overturn it. And VAR won't overturn it because the on-field ref has made a decision.
Yeah. No,
and then
you
get into a no-man's
land.
Yeah.
You've nailed it. So. You've absolutely nailed it.
I did hear in commentary, though, I think they were saying that the threshold for that type of offence this season has gone higher. In other words, you know, the amount of contact needs to be quite sufficient to whatever. I mean, in that case, I thought it was. I mean, because Ben Mee 1 is not then looking at Kane, at the ball, but he's got his arm around Kane. And the other thing that should be taken into account is the flight path of that ball was certainly heading straight towards where Kane wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I can understand sometimes when it looks like it's just sailing over and you think, well, he was never going to get to that anyway. But in that case, Kane has spun him and that's where the ball was going. And I just think that should count as well, I think. But I agree with you, Milo. The RRT is fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea, I'm with you there, Ricky. And I think, you know, it was a key point because, of course, Brentford then go up the other end. They go 2-1 up, and then we're left once again having to come back. And in the end, you know, I think we all thought that Sonny had won it in the 95th minute or whatever it was. That I thought that shot was sneaking in the corner, not quite enough juice on it, if you will. But you know, we go 2-1 up. Given that we will back Harry Kane to score a penalty regardless of what happened in Qatar. You know, it's a very different game. We might go on to win that game 3-1 or 4-1 because the confidence might be surging a little earlier. So it was a key moment for sure. Chaps, what did you think of Brentford?
Impeccable organisation. I like Thomas Frank. I quite like him in the interviews. He's just really refreshing. And he says it as he sees it. And he's quite, you know, he's quite fan-like as well sometimes with his compliments of his own team and, you know, our team. But I think, yeah, they're massively organised. He's doing really well with what he's got there. And I think their fans are lapping it up as well. I think they're in a good spot.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to be watching that. It wasn't particularly pretty, was it? But it was effective. They were well organised. You know, when you talk about kind of the relationship between a director of football and the scouting team and the analytics team. You know, Brentford are a very, very progressive team. They're leading a lot of this stuff in this country. Mm. They've been very, very smart in their transfers. And what you've got there is a team of players who are very well suited to the manager and what the manager wants. You know, obviously on a completely different budget to what we're working on, but it should be a textbook of how to work with a manager. And I think if you look at the league now, there's a load of these clubs. You know, Brighton are very similar and their scouting is just, you know, phenomenal. And they bring in players that no one else thinks of and they slot in really well. And you've got a load of these teams now in the middle of the league who are just, you know, brilliant at recruitment, signing players that, you know, really suit the manager, you know, difficult to beat, and just well organized. It's different to how it was, you know, 15, 20 years ago, where
definitely
kind of mid table and lower end of the league was just full of cloggers.
I think it's slightly annoying that Tony probably won't be playing against most of our opponents for the rest of the season. So,
well, I mean, we all knew that when those charges came rolling in, but in their hundreds, I may say, and set the improvement to be. I mean, he's guilty of them, right? So, I mean,
well,
it's
we
just
don't know yet. There hasn't been a hearing yet, but the charges, the hearing hasn't been heard yet. I mean, I'd assume if he's found guilty, he's going to be sitting out for 6 months or so, I would have thought.
Right.
But I think it's a bit disappointing when we've had a 6 week break in the middle of the season that they couldn't have at least brought forward a hearing and maybe had a hearing on some of the charges where they had the evidence and then maybe hear the other ones later on or something like that.
Yeah. And I mean,
because you're right, it's going to give a competitive advantage to some teams.
Well, it was so nailed on he was going to score. I mean, it was so nailed on he was going to score. I mean, you'd have put money on it yourself, wouldn't you? Maybe Ivan. Anyway, we'll leave that one alone. I agree. You know, Thomas Frank, you know, a really pretty impeccable character and manager, isn't he? He is the proverbial breath of fresh air. I think we can all agree. And he's fun to listen to, fun to look at. And as you said, Milo, Brentford are a really progressive club. So I don't think we have a bad word to say about them, really, do we?
Apart from their pitch and hoofing the ball and charging at us, but, you know.
Well, you know. So, yeah, we did actually have several bad words to say about them. You're right. All right, chaps, I suppose we should wrap it up in this relatively live pod with no edits. Thanks very much. I think we did well. Usually Cheers, the line Steph. That we say here is thanks, that was fun. It was fun with you, chaps.
We're back to the therapy sessions again, aren't we?
It's like the doctors are in. We're all counselling each other. Good Lord above.
Congratulations to all our listeners who made it this far. It might have been a bit of a slog for them in the middle, but, you know, Happy New Year.
happy new bloody year, and we won't charge you £100 for your therapy session this week. How about that? I think that our listeners should be thanking us. As I always do, because that's the... Anyway, we will be back next week to talk about our games against Crystal Palace midweek and Portsmouth in the FA Cup. Seriously, as well, thanks for joining us here for the first pod of 2023. We'll see you next week. And I do want to just slide this in. I think I speak for everyone on this pod. You know, it's a final thought. We referenced two songs, three songs, maybe even four songs by the seminal ska band, The Specials, earlier in this pod, because, as said, Terry Hall did sadly leave us over the holidays. It has been a big one. And just something that I was thinking, you know, we should, however miserable it might seem in life, this is going to sound like the life of Brian, isn't it? However you're feeling in life, and of course, look on the bright side of life. But let's take a reminder, shall we, from the brilliant cover that Terry and the Specials did to enjoy yourself whenever possible, even at Tottenham.
It did make me think, actually, I saw you'd written this in, that it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it, is pretty much the game is about glory, you know, not boring the other lot in song form. So, we can do Terry Hall stuff all the way through.
We could indeed. And again, really, what a loss. But anyway. Let's not end on a negative. Let's end on a positive. The Game is About Glory is back, as you've just heard. Thank you very much, and we will see you next week.